From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the first day of the last month in the race for the White House. For candidates, it's been a long, hard slog. But a much longer battle has been waged out in the hustings, a bitter street-level, court-level brawl over Americans' access to the ballot box, over provisional ballots, voter roll purges, early voting, absentee ballots, and yes, voter ID. There's been high principle and low politics, and in 1 month, that fight could make a big difference. This hour on Point, we try to bottom line the impact of the voter ID push and the battle over the ballot box. You can join the conversation this hour, have the fights over who will vote. Got you worried? What wins in this battle? What loses? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Roslyn, Virginia, for a look at the whole battleground is James Holman, national political reporter for Politico. James, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So this has just been a cascade in recent years of states, primarily states with Republican legislatures, implementing what kind of range of new laws to get tougher around the ballot box, James?
It all started with the 2010 midterm elections. Republicans made huge gains in state legislatures and won a lot of governor's seats. And for some time, there's been a mood and a sense on the right among conservative activists that there is widespread fraud. And so you saw after that midterm election a lot of legislation pass in 2011, really the year of the legislating. And then 2012 has been the year of the litigating. And the laws cover the whole gamut. And many of them are standing as is. Democrats are completely fine not challenging certain laws that have passed. But the key of the fight comes down to essentially access to the polls, when will people be able to vote, and how will people be able to vote. Can people use provisional ballots? Will they be counted? Under what circumstances? Who will get absentee ballots? When will they be sent out? And politics, as you noted, has entered into it, but those are really the two key thrusts of the fight.
We're going to try and get to a bottom line of what the impact of all this might be in this year, but I want to go to something you just said, James. There's a perception, there has been a perception in the GOP of widespread fraud. Now, I read around a lot in advance of this show looking for the numbers here, and I cannot find numbers of significance when it comes to fraud. In fact, a lot of them look very small. So is it really a perception of widespread fraud, or is there a perception of a political opportunity to, you know, tighten up a bit on that ballot box, maybe in a way that demographically, politically favors the GOP?
Yeah, Tom, if you put a lot of these folks on truth serum, they would tell you that they are ultimately trying to prevent Democrats from gaming the system. And that's honestly where they think they're coming from. A member of the Pennsylvania legislature, a Republican, was caught on tape talking to a Republican meeting about how he had helped Mitt Romney by passing Pennsylvania's very controversial voter ID law. And in Pennsylvania, there was a huge in Ohio, there was a huge concert on the eve of the 2008 presidential election. And Republicans think that Democrats were able to use that concert to get several thousand votes for Obama that he otherwise wouldn't have gotten. And so one of the changes that they made there was so that no one could send in those ballots for the 3 days before the election. And so, yes, Republicans are motivated by politics, but there is a mood among the activists, even if there's not the data to back it up, that people are gaming the system.
Now, by gaming the system, what do you mean? Do you mean voting?
I'll let the Republicans speak for themselves, but certain Republicans believe that people, if you go and you talk to people at Republican events and meetings in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, will tell you that they've heard horror stories which aren't substantiated or which criminal charges weren't filed behind, but people have these stories about voter fraud that they repeat.
You know, the whole point of journalism is to try to get beyond "I heard horror stories." Just to try to get down to what's really going on. And if there's fraud on a substantial scale, everybody would want to know about that. Everybody would want to do something about it. I guess, you know, we've called you up because we're trying to get to what's actually going on. And I guess let's look at, in the states themselves, how many of these laws are going to roll right on through and be in effect? on Election Day. How many are being turned back by courts or the Department of Justice at this point, James?
Tom, most of them have been turned back. A lot of them are being challenged. And there's still about a dozen or so cases pending in the courts, which could be significant. And the two places that reporters in Washington are paying the most attention to are Ohio and Pennsylvania, just because they're considered possible battlegrounds. The Pennsylvania judge is expected any time to rule on a case that was sent back to him by the Supreme Court. He had upheld the voter ID law, which, a state analysis found that as many as 9% of voters could be excluded with this voter ID law. The state in sworn testimony, a state official said there's no evidence of in-person voter fraud, getting to your question. And so the Supreme Court sent it back to the lower court on the grounds that there were some concerns the state law unfairly keeps people, unlawfully keeps people away from the polls. A judge is going to make a decision on that. We're waiting to see what is actually going to be in place in time for the election. And then in Ohio, the Obama campaign has become especially active, with the president's general counsel, Bob Bauer, personally making arguments before Ohio courts on two different cases. One is provisional ballots, which is if someone submits their ballot in the wrong precinct, can it be thrown out as it has been in the past? Democrats say that it's not fair to the voter, that it's unconstitutional because it wasn't the voter's mistake necessarily if they voted in the wrong precinct. The Obama campaign appears to have won on that count. What we're waiting for now is a judge, the final adjudication of the early voting case that I was mentioning earlier, where Democrats were able to get a lot of people to vote in that final weekend in 2008.
Which was legal.
Which was totally legal, completely. Republicans passed a law that got rid of the 3 days before the election, except members of the military could still early vote during that period. And so the Democrats were able to get a judge to restore the 3 days of early voting, saying that it's not fair to treat the military different than it is to treat regular voters, many of whom are minority voters. The Republican Secretary of State is still fighting this case, and the Attorney General in Ohio saying that there are a lot of different areas in law where you do distinguish between the military and regular people. The outcome of that could determine thousands of votes, which could be potentially pivotal in a battleground like Ohio.
Now, James, this tightening up, this general tightening up, some of it has been pushed back by courts and otherwise, but a bunch of it's going through. That may very well create more challenges to voters at the polls and therefore more provisional ballots, a phrase you just used. Those don't necessarily get counted so quickly. I mean, does this push us toward a possibility here of on November 6th, Americans are kind of accustomed to tuning in that night to find out who won, in this case, Obama or Romney. Might we look at something where this might drag on for a day or days as all these provisional ballots get dealt with?
Tom, that's a plausible scenario. You could see this not decided on election night. Right now, we're looking at these polls that seem to suggest President Obama has some kind of edge, but both campaigns believe the race is going to tighten up and it's going to come down to one or two states. When you make big changes to election law and procedures, you always have problems and kinks. And when you have a presidential election, there's always issues where certain ballots aren't counted and problems always arise. We've already seen some kinks in the system where new voter ID laws have been implemented. In some of these late primaries, for example, in New Hampshire and Rhode Island, they passed voter ID laws, and there were various issues reported in the last few weeks as they gave them a test run, and that's with relatively small turnout. So there is a danger that a lot of ballots won't be able to get counted on election night in key swing states like New Hampshire.
Which could leave us sitting around wondering exactly what's happened, if it's close, if this could be the margin of victory in some of these states. And then just in the last few days, we've heard, James, about this Strategic Allied Consulting. This was a firm headed by the former executive director of the Arizona Republican Party, doing work nationally, registering voters and more, that the GOP has just cut loose, fired, in effect, because what? They were found doing what?
They were making up fake voter registration forms and submitting them to county governments as new voters, and the scope of the investigation continues to spread. The firm says that it was one or two bad apples and that it's been isolated, but Florida is investigating it seriously, and other states where this firm has also been doing business, including North Carolina, another swing state, now reviewing the ballot submitted by this firm. The Republican National Committee very nervous about any taint of voter fraud on their own end, because as we were talking about earlier, they like attacking Democrats for and suggesting voter fraud, quickly fired the firm, and we'll see how much this investigation escalates.
Of course, it's an odd thing, because it could be, you could say, well, that's egg on the face of the GOP, but you could also say, well, there's proof this can be done and has been done in this case for Republicans, but there it is.
And it's why you need to draw a distinction between voter registration fraud and in-person voter fraud. It's one thing to make up fake voters when you're registering because you're getting paid based on how many voters you register.
Mm-hmm.
It's another to actually show up at the polling place and say that you're someone you're not and cast a ballot in the presidential election. And that's why it'll be interesting to see how much this spreads. And to your point, yes, it does show that people can create fictional registration forms. Thad McCotter, the Michigan congressman, resigned, but he wasn't able to get on the ballot because his own people had made up fake petitions, and that got him disqualified.
Bottom line, Jim, 2012, do you think that all these new laws could change the outcome of the presidential election?
It's possible.
Wow, that is in itself a great big thing to say. James Holman, national political reporter with Politico, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about voter ID and the great battle of 2012 over who will have access to the ballot box in this presidential election year. We're going to get a number of views in here. Right now, joining us from Gainesville, Florida, Daniel Smith, professor of political science at the University of Florida. Florida's been a hot battleground in the voter wars. Daniel Smith, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What do you see going on in your state? We had hanging chads and all the rest. Americans, you know, kind of get freaked out when we think back to how things can be tight and disputed. What about this whole national trend of tougher laws on who votes and how it's playing out, Daniel, in Florida?
Well, Tom, you know, what's interesting down here in Florida, voter ID is not an issue, but we have quite a few other issues that, depending on your perspective, is he either going to suppress the vote or eliminate fraud in the electoral process? Most of it dates back to House Bill 1355, which the Republican legislature passed unanimously in May of 2011. And it did three major things that have been adjudicated in federal courts across from Washington, D.C. down to Miami.
Hmm.
One has to do with reducing the time period that voter registration forms could be solicited, as well as having groups register themselves as a third-party voter registration organization. That was litigated and largely overturned in the federal courts in Washington, D.C. and
so
in Tallahassee.
They were trying to cut back on the amount of time that people could go out and try to register voters?
That's right. So in the past, we've had 10 days for the League of Women Voters to get out and register people or rock the vote or the NAACP. The legislature said that's too much time for manipulation. Let's reduce it down to 48 hours. Now, that has been overturned. It was overturned by a federal court in Tallahassee
So I can understand the logic of that, what would be the logic of having less time to encourage people to come out to vote? In a democracy, why does that make sense?
Well, it's more in terms of how long these third-party voter registration organizations would have the forms in their possession. So what the legislature was claiming is that there's too much time for manipulation, and a lot of it was dated back to ACORN and submitting these fraudulent voter registration forms. Well, I mean, there's a delicious irony, of course, in terms of this organization, Strategic Allied Consultants, who was hired by the Republican Party of Florida and funded by the Republican National Committee that James Holman talked about.
Now in trouble.
Now in trouble, because they had many bad apples, it turns out, not just one down in Palm Beach County, but you have suspicious forms being submitted in Palm Beach, in Duval County, in Jacksonville, in Miami-Dade, up in the Panhandle, in Escambia,
Still, it shows it can be. It shows it can be done if you're not caught, I guess.
Yes, and so one of the things that was upheld in that litigation was having tracking numbers, and so it's very easy to find out that RPOF, Republican Party of Florida ID number on each of these voter registration forms. Mm-hmm. It's 1193, and so when one of these suspicious forms turned up, they started looking at these tracking numbers and found that there are quite a few. And this comes with a felony. I mean, these are felony charges that these individuals might be facing, 5 years in prison, $5,000 fine for each infraction. So, I mean, it's serious.
It's serious. But that choking up on the process was turned back by the courts, and you've got two more.
Yeah, so the other main one is early voting. Early voting in Florida was passed by the Republican legislature in 2004 to expand it. In 2008, one-third of all Floridians cast early ballots. And African Americans in particular, more African Americans turned out to vote early over a 14-day period than did on election day or casting an absentee ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So African Americans in particular, on that final Sunday, made up over 34% of the electorate, even though they only make up 13% of the electorate. Now, the Republican
legislature, with no small number, we're reading here, going maybe straight from church by bus to vote.
Absolutely. These were souls to the polls efforts, mobilization, coordinated efforts. The Republican legislature didn't like it. African Americans voting 98% for Barack Obama in that election. So they eliminated the first 5 days of early voting, but also the final Sunday of early voting. And that has been the subject of several lawsuits with the Justice Department looking to see whether it will have any impacts on minority voter participation, as well as Representative Corinne Brown filing a lawsuit in federal court in Jacksonville.
All right. So that there's going to be less in Florida. Does that look to you like it makes a cleaner vote or just fewer people voting? How do you look at it?
Well, Tom, of course, there were no examples of any voter fraud going on in the first 14 days of early voting or on that final Sunday. So the legislature has reduced it down to 8 days, I think pretty intentionally to try to mitigate the likelihood African-Americans are going to come out on that final Sunday. We've also reduced from a mandatory 96 hours of early voting to anywhere between 48 and 96 hours set up by the 67 supervisors of elections. So we're going to have a net decrease in the number of hours. Now, the one saving grace is that the new law requires 8 hours of early voting on the first Sunday before the election, not the final Sunday. And so many groups are trying to recalibrate and make sure that they have the souls of the poll and other kind of campaigns to get folks to the polls on that first Sunday.
And there's a third piece here. Where does it stand?
That's right. Of this House Bill 1355 from May 2011 is provisional ballots. And that has been largely upheld. In the past, if you were a registered voter but had moved on election day from one county to another, and so I teach up here at the University of Florida. Most of our students come from Central and South Florida. Most of them registered to vote in high school in their home county. But in 2008, they could roll out of bed, they could go down to the student union, they could change their address and cast a regular ballot. The legislature had enough of that. They had too much turnout in their minds for people who were moving on election day. Again, no evidence of any voter fraud, but they said now if you move and do not update your address before you walk into the polling station, you will have to cast a provisional ballot. Now, Tom, I looked at the 2008 provisional ballots. We had about 35,000 cast in Florida in 2008. A little more than half were rejected. They were not valid votes. And that's largely because you have a 48-hour period to prove that you are who you are and that you are registered to vote and eligible to change your address.
And if you don't come back and do that, they're out.
They're out. And so, you know, again, James Holman was talking about how, you know, we may not have that election result. I can foresee having upwards of 10 times as many provisional ballots cast in 2012, because now anyone who moves will have to cast a provisional ballot. They'll have to then go to the supervisor of elections and prove that they are now a resident in this new county.
How do you do that? Do you go to some town hall, or where do you go to do that? Back to the voting place?
You have to go actually to the supervisor of elections office. And that can be, you know, quite a bit of driving or distance for many voters.
So we know just how important Florida can be before we even get to Pennsylvania, Ohio, and the rest. I mean, how significant do you think this sort of web of laws around the ballot box here may be in determining outcome this year and the timing of knowing the outcome, Daniel?
You know, I think the timing, if we are in a close election, certainly is going to be delayed. And we're not only talking about the presidential election, we're talking about any close races down ballot in which we're going to have this cure period, 48 hours for people casting provisional ballots. We really don't know the effects thus far with respect to the Sunday voting being eliminated and whether or not people who came out to vote on that final Sunday will change their behavior and vote on a different day or vote absentee or vote on election day itself. The voter registration laws have the potential of disenfranchising people. Every time that one of the bad apples of strategic allied consultants change someone's voter registration form, it could potentially lead to another provisional ballot being cast. So we really don't know. The other thing, Tom, that we haven't talked about at all is that Governor Charlie Crist, who was a Republican and was featured by President Obama at the convention in Charlotte, in 2000, during his term from 2007 through 2010, he and the Florida Parole Commission granted voting rights to over 150,000 ex-felons. In Florida, if you're an ex-felon, this is after you've done your time, you have to wait a minimum of 5 years up to 7 years, including nonviolent felons.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Crist and the Florida Parole Commission granted nonviolent ex-felons the right to vote, increasing the voter rolls. Governor Rick Scott, when he came into office, his oversight of the Florida Parole Commission changed that. And as a result, we had over 95,000 pending cases of ex-felons wanting to get their voting rights back. Thus far, only 255 individuals have had their rights to vote restored under Governor Scott. So we're talking about a huge segment of the electorate that was voting in 2008 that's not going to be eligible in 2012.
So, yeah. Professor, we're going to hear from a couple more voices in just a second here, but give us, from your Florida vantage, a very important one, look nationally. I mean, how do you feel what's going on in all these legislative changes, state legislatures across the country and more? Are we getting toward a cleaner vote? Are we moving toward vote suppression? On balance, what do you see happening here?
Well, you know, in many ways, this is vestiges of Jim Crow, and it's hard to deny that from the South. Now, can you argue that that's what's going on up in Pennsylvania or in other states that are tinkering with their voter ID laws? I mean, we are seeing a retrenchment of voting rights here in Florida. I think it's without question. And, you know, whether or not this is going to prevent fraud, well, you have to have fraud in the first place. It should be noted that of those ACORN fraudulent voter registration forms that were submitted back in the 2000s, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck were not getting voter registration cards mailed to them in the mail. This was an issue that was not really a problem. I think it's fine in terms of having these tracking numbers. The League of Women Voters thought it was fine to have those tracking numbers, and it does allow us to identify some of these bad apples. But the fact of the matter is we have very little fraud. In Florida, where the fraud exists, it's with absentee ballots, and the Florida legislature did nothing to tighten up the problem. And in Miami, I think there are three separate lawsuits right now with Republicans who had lost the primary suing because they think there was fraud in the absentee ballot process. But because that tends to benefit Republicans in general elections, the Republican legislature decided to turn a blind eye to where we really do have a small problem here in terms of voter fraud.
Daniel Smith in Gainesville, Florida, professor of political science at the University of Florida. Professor Smith, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
It's a big issue around the country. Comedian Sarah Silverman recently came out with a new video called Let My People Vote.
Can you believe it's election time again? Time to go to the local polling place, cross your name off the list, and vote. But this year, it's not going to be that easy, because there are these brand new, super up laws, which are presented as a way to prevent voter fraud, but are in fact designed to make it hard for specific people to vote. Black people, elderly people, poor people, and students. I wonder what those demographics have in common.
Okay, there's Sarah Silverman's take on it. GOP, some egg on its face last week, but here was the communications director for the Republican National Committee saying that even in a case where it was their own firm that had been hired and it wasn't looking so good, the Republicans would not stand for off-color tactics.
We at this point have an allegation. That mere allegation has caused us to act swiftly and boldly and sever our ties with this firm because we have a zero tolerance when it comes to this.
Zero tolerance from the GOP side, even though that one fell on their side of the line. I want to go right now to Washington, D.C., and Michael Bekesha. He's staff attorney for Judicial Watch. They've raised a lot of noise about problems with who's voting. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
And to Los Angeles, California, and Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola School of Law. He was the National Voter Protection Council for the Obama campaign in 2008, but he's looking straight at all this from an academic seat now. Justin Levitt, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So, Michael, we've seen this enormous wave of legislation on this front around the country. How do you see the net effect? Cleaner votes or vote suppression?
Well, first, Tom, you know, from my count, there's 31 states that currently have some form of voter ID laws, in fact. Five states passed legislation in 2003, four states passed in 2005, and three states passed legislation in 2006. So from 2006, before 2006, you know, more than a third of the voter ID laws were already in effect.
Yeah.
And so this isn't something new. This isn't something that has just happened.
And two-thirds since, you're saying?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Well, that's movement. And so what's the net effect?
Well, the net effect is cleaner elections and voters having confidence in the election process. The Supreme Court for the past 10 years has kept saying that it's important for voters to have confidence in their election process. You know, it just recently in, you know, in D.C., they were looking, the district court was looking at the Texas voter ID law. And there was this issue about whether or not Texas presented enough evidence of fraud. Mm-hmm. And the court said it doesn't matter. The court said that protecting the ballot box, safeguarding voter confidence is what's important. And states have the undisputable, you know, interest in protecting this voter integrity, voter confidence, and making sure and ensuring free and equal elections.
Where was that confidence before all this legislation came to pass, Michael? Did Americans spend a couple hundred years, you know, not confident about democracy as it was practiced here? Or...
Well, I think times have changed. I mean, with the 2000 election, I think people started questioning what the election process was and how to view the election process. And then with 9/11, you know, there was this idea that, you know, more IDs were needed in society. Now IDs are required, you know, almost everywhere you go, almost to do anything you want to do. And the bipartisan Carter-Baker report in 2005 even acknowledged and stated that showing ID at the polls is a good thing. And I think the American people believe that this is a good thing to ensure confidence in the election process.
Justin Levitt, how about it? Is this about confidence? Is it about shaping the voter turnout? What's more important here?
Well, Tom, you were talking earlier about mood without data, and that's what this reliance on confidence is. Actually, if you look at the numbers, and two professors published in the Harvard Law Review looked at the numbers, they went out and surveyed people to find out, do you actually have more confidence in the reliability of your elections depending on your state's laws, including ID laws? And it turned out the answer was no relationship whatsoever. People who think there's fraud in the system are going to think there's fraud in the system no matter what the laws are, and people who think there's not much fraud in the system will think there's not much fraud in the system no matter what the ID rules are. So I understand this compulsion to sort of act as if we knew what people thought. But when you look at the actual numbers, it doesn't actually increase confidence any, maybe in part because people see when their friends, colleagues, relatives are unnecessarily shut out or find it harder to vote, that takes away from their confidence as well. You know, we can only have elections with integrity if we're sure that all of the eligible voters who wish to vote are able to do so.
Well, can we move away then from mood to fact? Do we have a voter fraud problem in the country? Have we had one?
We have a fraud problem, but it's fraud by election officials. So where it happens in some very old-fashioned ways. It happens with buying votes for smaller races, things like county commission, city council. It happens in the absentee system. It happens with good old-fashioned stuffing the ballot box. Those things still undeniably happen. The one thing they all have in common is not a single one of them could be stopped by requiring real people, real voters, to show ID at the polls. And Michael mentioned before, you know, people got scared about the election of 2000. Not one single problem, and there were plenty, they were legion, not one single problem in 2000 could have been affected by stronger ID rules either.
Of course,
we have to aim our solutions at the problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's, 5 weeks now to Election Day, and we're talking about voter ID and the battle in this election year, 2012, over who will have access to the ballot box. Michael Bakesha is with us from Judicial Watch in Washington, Justin Levitt from Loyola School of Law in Los Angeles, California. It is easy for some folks and not easy for others to get out and get the kind of required ID that many states now ask for. Morning Edition last week on NPR interviewed Pennsylvania resident Kathleen Herbert, 68 years old, has multiple sclerosis, uses a motorized wheelchair, had to get a bus and a lot more, waiting hours to update the address on her ID so she could vote next month. Here she is.
I think it's stupid. Folks that have been voting all their life like me, it shouldn't have to go through this.
Shouldn't have to go through this. On the other hand, Republicans say in many states, let's clean it up. Let's be sure. Now, exactly for what? Well, here was Pennsylvania House Republican leader Mike Terzai. He made headlines in June at a Republican state committee meeting talking about what had been accomplished in the legislative session. He had this to say about the newly passed state voter ID law as a winning strategy for his party and for Mitt Romney.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
And you hear the response right there. Michael Bekesha, speak to that. I mean, that sounds like a straight-up political description of legislation around an American right.
You know, I've never met the speaker, and I don't know exactly what he meant to be saying there or what he was saying there. But what I do know is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court recently heard the case about voter ID. And all the justices on that court, including the Democrats, stated that they have no argument that a requirement to show some form of ID is okay. The problem right now in Pennsylvania isn't the law. No one disputes that the law is constitutional under the Pennsylvania Constitution. What everybody's talking about now is implementation. And the state is working extremely hard to make sure everybody that is qualified and eligible to vote will be able to vote.
You know, I'm not sure that's the way I heard their decision. I mean, didn't they say to the lower court judge, under the Pennsylvania Constitution, if this creates any imposition, any impediment to voting, then it cannot stand and you have to turn it back?
They didn't, Tom. What the court did say was that they had concerns about the implementation because the law didn't go into effect until recently. If the Department of Transportation could provide the free IDs and educate the public in enough time. They were not saying that the legislation, you know, in the abstract is unconstitutional. And since March, the Department of Transportation has provided over 10,000 free IDs. They are using social media, using the television, newspapers to educate the public so they understand what is needed and what is required at, you know, when they go to cast their ballot. You know, in Pennsylvania, it's not just a state ID that can be used. It's also college IDs, as well as care facilities, such as nursing homes. Nursing homes are able to provide their residents with IDs, and those can be used on election day to cast their ballots.
Just 11 nationally. How do you see the net effect here between all these, you know, tightening up on how long a period people can vote in, on the kind of ID that they need? Between legislatures and courts, where do you see the trend? How much has it tightened or not, finally?
Well, I think the guest in the first segment, James, had a very good point, which is there was an awful lot of legislation in 2010, 2011. And by and large, from my perspective, the worst of it, the legislation that most unnecessarily made it most difficult for voters has been turned back in some ways mitigated either by the courts or by further legislative or administrative action. What that means is, by and large, I think success for the American people. The landscape shifted a bit, but the worst of the worst isn't going to affect people when they come to the polls in November. And that's something that I think everyone across the board can feel more comfortable with than they might have had the landscape stayed the same as it was last year.
And still, in key swing states, we may be seeing a margin of outcome that comes pretty directly out of this. Let's get our listeners in here. Ellen in Munster, Illinois. Ellen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say I am a young, fairly naive voter.
Okay.
I think this is the first time I've really ever paid attention at all.
Okay.
But when it comes to the voter ID stuff, I don't think it ever occurred to me in the last few times that I voted that I didn't need my ID. I live, you know, I always took an ID. Nobody necessarily asked me for it, but I didn't know if that was just small town or what. So it surprised me.
So
you don't have to show an ID to prove you are who you say you are.
Well, would you feel comfortable if everybody was asked to show an ID? And what about those who, there's significant numbers in some states, it's kind of surprising if you're young and out and working and everything else, but there's some significant numbers who don't have them. What do you think about requiring it, Ellen?
Well, it seems like it's required for lots of other things. And I do think we live in a time now where it's more important for us to prove that we are who we say we are. I mean, I would love it if we could all just trust each other. But unfortunately, that's not how we live anymore. And so it might be, it's unfortunate it happens in an election year. I think maybe lots of important things come from an election year. But maybe it's an opportunity for us to recognize that we have to have better ways for people to get access to an ID.
Ellen, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Rosalind in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Rosalind, you're on the air.
Well, I wanted to say that I really felt experiencing with my mother and her four sisters, who are all over 90 in Indiana, how difficult it was to get them an ID. They live on a cash economy. They never drove. Their husbands always drove.
Mm-hmm.
And this disenfranchises millions of women in their 90s in nursing homes or living in poverty who have to find their way to a Department of Registry to get an ID. And it was very difficult. I flew out. I got my aunts in the car with all their walkers. We got them. But I'm saying a lot of people don't have relatives like that who can help them get it. And I think people who feel that everyone has an ID really are not in touch with a lot of people in nursing homes and people over 90.
What do you say to a young voter like Ellen who say, well, you know, she's thinking, look, the age we live in, maybe people just ought to get their ID. That solves the problem, Rosalind.
I think she could really help by visiting a nursing home and perhaps driving some of those people to the Department of Registry, sitting with them, waiting with them, getting their walkers in and out of the car and helping them get it. That is something that, and I found that my aunt, who's now 101, who worked at the polls for 60 years, suddenly at the very same poll couldn't vote without a picture ID.
Yeah, Rosalind,
so
I appreciate your...
That's really, really voter suppression.
Thank you for your call. Justin, I mean, there you've got both ends of it. Rosalind putting a lot of time into helping her mother and her mother's sisters to get what they needed to vote. But young Ellen saying, well, this is the time we live in. People have IDs. People use them. It doesn't seem to young Ellen like too much to ask, Justin.
And I think the calls were great for highlighting part of the issue. I think that Ellen's absolutely right. We should all be able to and have to say that we are who we say we are. 50 states have different ways for us to say that we are who we say we are. It's every single state has some sort of provision where you have to prove your identity. The difference, I think, is the very few. So I think we're at 7 states before litigation and now about 5, where the only way you can show that you are who you say you are is using one government-issued picture. And there, I think Rosalind has the better of the argument. You know, most of us have government-issued photo ID, but many of us don't. And voting is a right, not just for most of us, but for every single American voter. It's at the heart of our constitutional order. And Ellen's correct that we need to help more people get ID, but that can't be at the expense of a constitutional right that they have, whether they have a government-issued piece of paper or not. You know, none of us come out of the womb bearing photo ID. And unfortunately, we still have, as you mentioned, not a majority, but an awful lot of people in the society who don't have that single document and who have just as much of a right to vote as I do or as Ellen does or as Rosalind does.
Michael Bakesha, if the numbers don't show nationwide a significant fraud problem, then why not lean toward access? I mean, isn't that the beauty of a democracy? We're supposed to rely on the collective wisdom of the people. Why not get them all in there, 101 especially, with their advantage of years of insight?
Absolutely. I think everybody has the right to vote and everybody should vote. And everybody that wants to vote in these states is going to have the opportunity.
Then why
to do
make
so.
It harder if there's not a demonstrated problem in the numbers when it comes to fraud?
Well, in a lot of cases, it's not that much more difficult. In a lot of states, majority of the voters have some form of ID. You also have absentee ballots. You have provisional ballots. There are many ways that voters can demonstrate they are who they say you are. And in these states, you know, like Pennsylvania, the state is going through, they're working as hard as possible to ensure that every person that wants to vote, that is eligible to vote, will be able to vote on election day.
I mean, how can you say that? You heard the majority leader saying, you know, we changed this and it's going to get Mitt Romney elected.
Like I said, I heard that on YouTube, but
well, you can't ignore it, right? I mean, you just asserted that they're trying their best to make sure everybody can vote, but what he said sounded like the opposite.
Absolutely, and he's the Speaker of the House in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
He's not the executive. The implementation of the law is up to the governor and specifically Department of Transportation, the Secretary of State. And the executive branch in Pennsylvania is doing everything it can do to ensure that every single person that wants to vote is going to vote. And, you know, this is what's going on around the country. That is why when the Supreme Court looked at the Indiana case and that voter ID, it saw that the state was doing what the state needed to do to ensure that no individual that wanted to vote was going to be disenfranchised.
Well, I mean, that... it just seems beyond a government's power to ensure that if you put in tough laws that are hard to meet. I mean, they're not going to be out there escorting everybody down to whatever office they need to get to. We heard that in that NPR clip. You know, the woman who's in her nursing home and just spent, I don't know, hours getting on a bus, hours sitting and waiting down at the DMV. That's not exactly hand-holding.
And Tom, particularly on that line, so that clip that you heard was about a woman who was updating her address. And if you have an ID, yeah, it's possible. It can be a royal pain in the neck, as any of us who've ever dealt with a DMV know. But it's possible to update or to renew. For those who don't have ID, though, it's twice as hard or 10 times as hard in order to get the ID you need. So, for example, in Arkansas, you need a birth certificate, an official certified copy of a birth certificate in order to get a photo ID. But in order to get a birth certificate, you need to show a photo ID. So you're trapped in a loop where you need a document to get a document that you don't have unless you have the first document. For people who have lived, and it's quite possible to live in today's society even without showing an ID everywhere, for people who've lived without a current valid government-issued photo ID, it turns out to be rather difficult to get one in the first place.
David's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the Republican organization that was caught with a few bad apples really intended to make elections fair. It seems to me they would have had a mechanism in place by which they would have been able to take care of bad apples.
If you mean the one in Florida, though, David, I mean, that was a private company. Yes, it had a former Republican party official from Arizona at its head, but it was hired by the GOP, but it wasn't the GOP itself.
But if you're hired, you know, the person hiring can specify the parameters of the work. And I would think that they would be very, very sensitive to this and require any company to have such checks in any contract that they would have had.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the first time that outfit got in trouble, so there was a track record there, but they're in trouble now. I appreciate your call. David, Fred in Derry, New Hampshire. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm trying to turn off my radio. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, briefly. Voting is a right, not a privilege, and that makes a difference between having to have photo ID or not. I couldn't have said it any more eloquently than the guest who stated that we don't arrive with an ID. We're not born with it.
So you're not looking for more speed bumps here in terms of getting in to vote. Michael Bekesha, what about a right, not a privilege? So just open the door, sir.
Absolutely. Voting is a right, and everybody that is eligible should have the right to vote and does have the right to vote. And all the legislation that does around the country is to ensure that the person who is voting is who they say they are. That is all it's trying to do. It's not trying to disenfranchise any individual, group of individuals, or any voter that would vote for a particular party or particular issue. These laws are in place to ensure integrity, to ensure the public has confidence in the elections, and that everybody is who they say they are. You know, 100 years ago, this wasn't probably as big of a problem because you voted in your small towns and the poll workers, the election officials knew who everybody is.
A lot of big cities 100 years ago. Plenty.
There were, but the wards, the counties, where you voted were smaller. Now our country's a little bit more transient. People come and go, and all this does is to ensure that those who are voting are who they say they are. Judicial Watch is also working around the country to ensure that voter registration lists, that the rolls are accurate, that you don't have more than 100% of the voting age population on the rolls. And that's for the same reason, to make the process more modern, more efficient, and so that everybody that's going to vote will feel as though their vote counts.
Justin Levitt, honest effort or vote suppression?
Well, I think it's part of both. I think it's honestly misguided. I think it's a little bit of security theater without a lot of thought to the real costs and benefits at the end of the day. You heard Michael talk before about people having a way to vote through the absentee system. making things harder at the polls, no question, drives people to the absentee system. The problem is that's where we actually find fraud. We find people stealing absentee ballots. We find people coercing others. You find vote buying through the absentee system because now you've got a receipt to show in exchange for whatever, you know, cash or goods you've been promised. The absentee system, and this, I think, is recognized across the board. That's one where we've really got a problem. Making it harder to vote at the polls just funnels people into a system that we know is troublesome.
Bottom line, do you see an outcome on November 6th that may be changed by all of these efforts?
I think, and here too, I don't think it depends on your partisan preference or anything like that. I think everyone hopes the answer is no. The election administrator's prayer, "Dear Lord, let this one not be close." And I think that everyone hopes that the election is decided by something other than the ground rules of how eligible individuals go to the polls.
You think everybody hopes that?
I believe they do. I think people want their elections decided based on the right choice for the country and not the rules of the game.
Michael, do you think problems at the polls will change the presidential outcome this year, one way or the other?
No, I don't think so. I think there won't be any problems and the election will go smoothly and everybody that wants to cast a ballot will be able to do so.
You two are very optimistic gentlemen. We'll see on November 6th. I see plenty of successors to hanging chads threatening here, but we'll see. Justin Levitt at Loyola School of Law, I appreciate your time. Michael Bakesha with Judicial Watch, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.